fourth week in our five-week class. And today's subject will be how to include the world of thoughts, a cognitive world, as part of mindfulness practice. I know many of you have dutifully put off thinking until this week. And, immediately just staying with your breath. But now, it's okay to start thinking. But before I do that, I thought it might be nice to take a few moments, again, as I often do, to ask you if you have any questions or concerns or reports about how it's going so far. Yes?
I had spoken with you last week about finding that as I was aware of my breathing, I would feel like I wasn't breathing enough. And it would produce a kind of a sensation of wanting to take a breath, which didn't have very much flow to it. And you advised me to watch that, see what happened. And that indeed things have loosened up. But I have a feeling that I'm meditating from a different position in the room, that instead of being sort of in here, I went over there. Or just looser connection to that sensation. And then it wasn't really something I know how I did, but that kind of making it bigger made it less.
So before, when you were tense, as you're riding too close on top of the breathing?
Almost. That's a pretty good description.
And that now you kind of step back and kind of bird's eye view of the breath. So if that's helpful for you, that's great. It can happen that we get we're kind of like pouncing in our experience, or we get really kind of controlling, we're kind of involved, or get really tight in there with the experience. And that's not particularly useful. The idea is to make lots of room for the experience we're having, make lots of room for the breath, and in all that room, in all that space, to let it unfold as it wishes. So what you've described, kind of stepping back and kind of being up here and watching, sounds like a nice alternative to being really tight. However, I have this to say, and that is that I try somewhat intentionally not to use the language of watching to talk about mindfulness, because some people will kind of be up here watching and manipulating as if they're separate from the experience, and it lends itself to kind of being removed or aloof or disassociated. For some people, it's quite extreme. So I tend not to use that kind of language, even though it's the classic language to watch. In favor of such language as to sense and to feel, which is much more intimate. So for you, what you're doing might be just the right thing for you, and you might see if you can do that more to kind of create that spacious kind of, like you're in the back seat just kind of watching it all unfold. And then as you get more comfortable with that, you might see if there's a way you can kind of, in the spirit of that spaciousness, allow yourself to get closer so you can actually sense and feel rather than just watch. Does that make sense? So kind of a middle ground between what you did before and what you're doing now.
I have a question about just practice. It's easier for me if I use a tape or something like that. And also, I wonder if it's better to do every day shorter time or less frequently per week and maybe longer times.
Uh-huh. What's your thoughts on that? Okay. So my thoughts around using a tape, there's a lot of props you could use for meditation. And you said it was easier. that's one thing that makes it nice about tapes, is that tapes can keep us on track, because we tend to just wander off and get lost. And so they keep us on track, they keep us kind of reminding to stay present, to come back. And there can be a very nice voice or some music, and it's really soothing and relaxing, and we get relaxed. And we think that makes it easy to get relaxed and at ease. But what we're not doing when we're relying on a tape is what we're not doing is strengthening our own mind's ability to do that for ourselves. And actually, even though you might be getting relaxed, it's nice to get relaxed, relaxation is not the goal of this practice, this meditation here. The goal, is, if there is one, is to strengthen that muscle so we can do that for ourselves. So we ourselves can bring, have the skills and the strength of mind to stay in the present moment without needing anything outside of us to keep us going. And it's more important, so if you keep relying on a tape, you're losing the opportunity to develop that muscle for yourself, even though you might be getting relaxed.
So you think for, if you're, like, I'm just starting up again, I've been this for a while,
yeah.
I stopped and started a lot, but to do it for a while to kind of get rolling and then maybe quit using the tape would be...
Well, if you want, yeah, it's okay with me, it's okay. I'm kind of, it's more of a personal preference rather than a policy, but my attitude towards such things is just jump in directly by yourself without the life vest. one of the subtle things you're conditioning yourself to if you use a tape even in the beginning is to associate successful meditation with getting calm or relaxed. And successful meditation is not necessarily defined by calm or relaxation. It's defined by how well you can be present for what's going on.
And then what about frequency?
Frequency. That's an individual matter. And there's a lot of things that goes into that consideration. But to make it somewhat simple, I think that it's most useful to have a daily sitting practice, to sit every day. And so if that means that you have to sit shorter periods of time, then so be it. So if you sit for half an hour every day, there's a continuity of momentum that happens when you sit every day that doesn't happen if it's on again and off again, on again, off again. So I would choose a length of time that works for the kind of life you live and then make some kind of commitment to sit that way every day or most every day. I told someone today that when I first started meditating, I used the model of how they meditated at the San Francisco Zen Center as how I was going to do it too. And so I meditated twice a day, every day, for 40 minutes, except on Sunday. Because at the Zen Center, no one meditated on Sunday. So then you're supposed to have a day off. So I was kind of, you don't have to be, So, whatever that means. Any other concerns or questions about your experience? Anything difficult, particularly difficult, or that you want to ask about? Or yes.
If you have a time when there's a lot of chatter or distraction going on, and you find it difficult to meditate. I usually meditate when I first wake up in the morning, and I usually find that's a good time to do it. This morning when I went to do it, it just I couldn't sleep at all. And so after about 20 minutes, I gave up. But I wondered, do you have a suggestion when you find that happening? Sometimes, I mean, do you just keep up and try some other time?
It's pretty rare that occasionally it can be useful to stop sitting, because of something happening. But generally it's best to stay with whatever's going on. And part of the art of that is to step back and see if you can get the most global picture of what's going on. Because if a person is really restless and really the chatter mind is going on, they're trying to stay with the breath, then they're struggling against what's really going on versus their idea of where they're supposed to be. So let go of the breath and step back and just meditate on a chattering mind. And that's what we'll talk about today, is thinking and how to include that. So the whole lesson today maybe is useful for you. The art of this kind of practice is to learn how to allow and accept and recognize what is really going on in the present moment. And if we are not doing that, then we're setting up a tension between what we think we're supposed to be doing versus what's really happening. So, and that's not a very useful tension. If what's really happening mostly is just complete restlessness and chatter, forget about the breath. Just be completely present for restlessness. Do a meditation on restlessness. Be the first person ever to die of restlessness in meditation. sometimes it's very dramatic what can happen in our inner life from day to day, from hour to hour, depending on circumstances in the world or whatever. And sometimes a hugely successful period of meditation is simply that you stayed on the cushion until the end. Because sometimes it's like being on a bronco, you know, wild horse, you know, just like, just to stay on there, and you're cultivating patience and strength of presence and discipline in doing that. It's quite powerful to do it. So I'm generally of the school of just, once you decide to sit down to meditate for a certain length of time, stay with it and face yourself and learn what it is you have to accept so it's okay to sit there. Well, you're more than welcome to stay, and maybe all of it won't make sense to you, but maybe some of it will and be useful. So you're welcome to come. Okay, well, let's start with a little sitting.
Change the
light. Yeah, maybe the lights. So take a comfortable but alert posture. And then to begin this time, take a few moments to notice what kind of, if any, what kind of concerns, what kind of themes is predominant for you now or this evening, today. What are the concerns that might are most likely to pop up in the course of your meditation? So acknowledging what that might be, perhaps will it make you a little bit more alert to notice when your mind gets involved in those thoughts. Notice when it gets lost in those concerns. If you can notice it sooner, then you're more less likely to wander off into that concern. So take a couple of deep breaths. As you breathe in, connect to your body. As you breathe out, relax. And then let your breath breathe itself normally. Making room in your awareness for the experience of breathing, the inhalation, the exhalation. Whenever your mind wanders off in thought, notice that that's happened. Take a moment to feel what it's like to be lost in thought. And then softly come back again to the felt sense of your breathing. Mindfulness is not thinking about your experience. It's the silent observation or the silent presencing of what is happening. Many of us know what the smell of a rose is, but we would have a difficult time explaining it in words, what that smell is like. Our thoughts about the smell of the rose is very different from the direct experience of smelling. Our thoughts about a massage are very different from the direct experience of receiving that massage and feeling it. Our thoughts about music are very different from the receiving of the sounds. It's this wonderful, silent ability to sense and feel, which is what mindfulness is. Not to think about our breath, but to receive the sensations of breathing, arising and passing away, in that silent awareness that knows what is going on as it's happening. Establishing the awareness on the breath and then sustaining the awareness there. not letting the mind wander off into thoughts, but rather staying present for each inhalation and exhalation. Stay with the breathing the best you can. But the next time you find yourself wandering off into thought, take a few moments to notice something different about the thoughts, different about the thinking and the content of the thoughts. Notice, for example, the relative strength or weakness in which the inner voice is speaking those thoughts. Notice whether that inner voice is impatient or calm or anxious or delighted. Notice the amount of energy that seems to be associated with that kinds of thinking. Spend a little time with those thoughts and notice what you can find out what you can notice about them. It's different than the story and the content. What is it about the process of thinking that you can notice in your experience? When you find yourself caught up in your thoughts, notice your relationship to that thinking, those thoughts. Are you interested or fascinated, apprehensive or concerned? Are you judgmental? Things, all those, the relationship and reactions we have to our thinking, our relationship to thinking, is a part of the process of thinking which is not the story or the content of the thoughts. the sense of urgency that might be there with it. And then come back again to your breathing. And for the next minute or so, relax and rest the best you can with the in-breaths and the out-breaths. So, a useful image, I think, for describing or this kind of practice is that of the spiders in a spider web. And the way I see it, the spider sits in the center of the web and just sits there and kind of waits for something to happen. At some point, something will happen elsewhere in the web. An insect lands on the web someplace. At which point the spider leaves the center and goes and attends to whatever has occurred elsewhere on the web. And then once it's finished attending to the insect, it comes back and sits in the middle of the web again. It's a little bit the same way in this meditation practice. Each of us sits in the middle of the web. In Buddhism, we say it comes sometimes the mandala, the web of our human experience. And the center of our web for the meditation is our breath. We stay with the breathing. And then when something else happens on our web, then the instructions is to let go of the breath, let go of the center of your web, and go up and visit, attend to this other experience that's happening. And so something, it can be anything. It can be our physical sensations. It can be sound. It can be our emotions, which I talked about last week, and it can also be our thoughts. Anything that we can experience can be the subject of mindfulness meditation. There's nothing in the realm of human experience which is considered to be outside of what we can pay attention to. This is one of the reasons why we say there's no distractions in this kind of meditation. It's just more stuff to pay attention to. And part of the great beauty and power of this practice is that our whole humanity is included, with the aim of becoming balanced, where we're not artificially selecting out or denying certain parts of our experience, but willing to be open for the whole realm of our experience equally, whatever comes up. And in a sense, that's what makes this practice sacred. It's sacred in that the way I define sacred is that there's no outside. As soon as you have something which is considered to be outside of the practice, outside of what's acceptable to pay attention to, then you've left the sacred realm. The sacred is that which holds everything in awareness. So we sit in the center of our web with our breath, and then these things happen, and we go up and take care of them. And then when we're finished, we come back to the center, to our breath. The difference between our experience and that of the spiders is that the spider web always has its physical center. For us, we take our center with us. So you don't have to think, you know, that once you're paying attention to your emotions or your physical sensations, that you have some place you have to get back to in order to do the meditation right. You're exactly where you're supposed to be if you're paying attention to what is predominant. Now, thoughts are an important part of our life and also a problematic part of our life. There's a lot of wonderful creative aspects of thoughts, of thinking, and there's a lot of painful and even destructive aspects of our thinking also. Much of our what we think of as being our humanity is often associated with what happens through our thoughts. Much of civilization is just an expression of thoughts for the most part. And many of us overemphasize the importance of our thinking. Many of us are just kind of constantly inhabiting the world of our thinking, our thoughts, as if nothing else exists. No other way of experiencing life exists than simply experiencing it through the filter of our thoughts. Meditation is not supposed to silence our thoughts. It isn't that we're supposed to have a completely silent mind that doesn't think at all. That can happen occasionally, but it's not really the function of mindfulness practice to make that happen. Meditation is simply recognizing and noticing what is happening in the present moment as it's happening, not trying to make some different kind of experience, not to make a silent experience without any thinking. So thoughts are included as part of it all. However, thoughts can be are rather tricky. And part of the way that thoughts are tricky is we tend to get very easily caught up into our thoughts, into our preoccupation with our various ideas and stories and whatever goes on. An analogy for this that I like saying is that of watching football on television. Bear with me, those of you who have heard this a number of times. I had the experience some years ago of watching football on television with two other meditation teachers. And I don't usually watch football on television, so it's kind of like that was kind of a new experience for me. So I was kind of interested in the whole experience. And my friend who had the mute button, when as a sensible person I think does, hit the mute whenever the commercials came on. And then I thought a sensible person would also hit the mute button to get the sound on again when the game started. But my friend didn't do that. And there were the three of us watching this football game without any sound. And so rather than complain, I thought, this is interesting, I'm going to notice what's going on here. And one of the things I noticed was that there was a world of difference between watching the football game with a sound on versus a sound off. It was actually much more relaxing, and in a sense, more deeply pleasant to watch without the sound. With this, without the sound, I can kind of follow what was going on with the game. I know enough about football to see these guys are standing facing each other. Something happens and they all fall down. You know, and it's kind of exciting, and then they stand up again, they do it again. And then occasionally someone kind of breaks free, and I can see them running with the ball, and it's at the 40-yard line, and I can see, oh, it's good, they're heading the right direction, 30-yard line, oh, good, he might make it. The 20-yard line, oh, it's nice, you know. Oh, here comes someone out of the left. Oh, he tackled him, oh, he didn't make it. Well, it's the way it goes sometimes. You know, so I know what's going on. But when the sound is on, what happens is that I also have the commentators, sportscasters speaking. And suddenly, it's, oh yes, he broke free, he's at the 40, he's at the 30, oh my God, he's at the 25, here it comes so-and-so, and oh! And I'm sitting on the edge of my seat, if not I'm standing, you know, and then I'm so let down when he gets tackled. Oh, it's so hard. And something happens, it's different when I'm listening to the commentator than it is when I don't listen to the commentator. And one of the things I realized is that until that experience of watching the football without sound, I thought that I didn't see the difference between the commentator and the football game. I thought the two were the same thing. I mean, if someone had asked me, of course I would have said they were different, but I hadn't ever considered it. And I thought, of course, I kind of acted as if they were the same thing. They're actually two very different things. And it's possible to see them as different things, and you have a very different experience depending on whether you relate to the game as a game or you relate to the game through the filter of what the commentator is being paid to do, which is to get you excited, I think. Now, it's fine for that to happen on television, but no one's paying us to make commentary. And we're constantly making commentary all the time of our experience. And what happens for us also is we tend not to see the difference between the commentary we make about our experience in the present moment and what's actually happening in the present moment. So, you know, we walk into a room, we see someone, and our commentary is, oh, that person is... you know, so and so, or that person. I mean, that person is such and such a kind of person. You know, we already jump to generalization and conclusions before we even talk to them and find out who they are. We made a commentary about that person, and it's fine. The mind does that to make commentary, to make comments. But then, rather than seeing it as a commentary which is maybe not even accurate, we then start to relate to that person through that commentary, rather than seeing the commentary as maybe different than the person. And if we see it different, then maybe we can make some attempt to meet the person fresh, to find out it's really, really true. Same thing with our inner experience. We're very quick to make comments about our inner experience. We have certain emotions, and we make comments about them, what they mean, what's going to happen, the consequences of it. We get depressed, and we make all these commentaries about depression. This happened to me before, and because it happened to me before, I know what's going to happen now. And I know what it's going to mean when I go here and there, and if it continues any longer, then I know what, you know, this is bad to be depressed. It's embarrassing to be depressed. I better hide it from my friends. We make all these judgments and commentary about it, which I'm proposing to you tonight, is very different than the experience itself. Part of the great power of this mindfulness practice is we learn to separate, distinguish a little bit, the commentary from direct experience. So we have more room to be free in the middle of the experience rather than entangled in the commentary. Now this entangled in the commentary, being entangled in our thoughts, is a very fascinating thing. Why do we get preoccupied in our thoughts? Why do we get caught up in them? This is, I think, very fascinating to study, and each of you maybe can study this for yourself. Why do you get so caught up and lost in the kind of thinking that you have? I find it phenomenal that if anybody talked to me out loud as much through the day and through the week as I talk to myself and did it in as repetitive fashion as I do to myself, at the best of it, I'd be begging them to stop. You know, at the worst of it, I don't know. I don't want to imagine. But I'd be totally bored. You know? If not, you know, shut it up. But when I do it inside my own head, I don't seem to almost ever get bored. Not only that, but it's as fresh and as interesting each time. And as important. Each time, even though I've thought the same thought 326 times. So why is that? What's the difference when we hear it from someone else, the same thing, and we do it for ourselves the 300th time? And why is it so fresh and so important? And that, I think, is a very interesting thing to investigate for each of you. What I suggest to you, you might find it different for you, but what I suggest is that much of our thinking is very much concerned with ourself. It's very much self-centered. It's very much understanding the situation, understanding who we are in relationship to other people and other situations. It's measuring and judging ourselves. It's protecting ourselves. It's all kinds of things about us. I don't know what percentage of our thoughts are self-centered thoughts and how much of them are other-centered. But even when we think about other people sometimes, there's often kind of a, you know, how is this in relationship to me? So this is not necessarily bad to do this, but so much of our commentary, I believe, our comments, is seeing the world and seeing ourselves through a filter of self-concern. And we are not really necessarily impartial observers to ourself in the world. And part of the reason we get caught up and preoccupied so much in our thoughts is because we're very interested in this world of self, this world of what it means to me, what effect it's going to have on me, what's going to happen to me tomorrow, and whatever. And so we get enchanted and we get pulled into this world of thoughts for various reasons. Mindfulness practice is a practice of waking up from the dream of being preoccupied and lost in our thoughts. Thoughts are not our enemies in mindfulness practice. We're not trying to, which some meditators think. What we're trying to overcome is not thinking. What we're trying to overcome is a tremendous power of identification and preoccupation with our thinking. And that's a very important distinction. Because if you don't see that distinction, then the tendency is to think that thoughts are the problem. Thoughts are not the problem. What we're trying to do is not to get lost in the thoughts by our preoccupation in them. Because we're lost, we're not awake. You can be awake and know that you're thinking. You can be thinking and not be awake. Mindfulness is not thinking about things. It's not thoughtfulness. But mindfulness, when thinking is happening, mindfulness is the clear awareness that thinking is happening. Very simple, right? At least simple for me to say. So thoughts are an important part of our life, an important part of what happens on the cushion. And there's all kinds of levels of strength through our preoccupation and thoughts. And depending on the intensity of our thinking, depends a lot on how we relate to it in our mindfulness practice. Now, as I give you the instructions for thoughts, listen to me carefully. And notice if I slip into suggesting somehow subtly, perhaps, the idea of mindfulness of thoughts is to do that so you can get rid of your thinking. Because often the way we talk about it and the way we give instructions sounds that way. It's not what I mean to say. What I'm trying to teach you to do is how to strengthen your wakefulness so your wakefulness is stronger than your preoccupation with the thoughts. Make sense? It's kind of like some thoughts are black holes. You know these black holes in the sky, in the space? They're stars that have collapsed. And because they've collapsed, the gravitational force of these stars is so incredibly powerful that light traveling that goes into those stars doesn't leave because the gravity is so strong, so that they're dark there. Certain preoccupations with certain thoughts are like black holes where the light of awareness goes in but never comes out. What we're trying to do is strengthen our ability, strengthen that light so that light is stronger than the black hole. So how do we do that? If we find ourselves involved in thinking as we meditate, and if the thinking is relatively mild, kind of minor kind of chatter, random kind of thoughts, it's usually best just come back to the breathing and cultivate your presence, cultivate your ability to stay present on your breathing. Just keep coming back and keep coming back. But what will happen sooner or later is that your preoccupation with certain thoughts are such that they're stronger than your ability to very lightly, easily come back to the breathing. And then what you want to do is just very matter-of-factly, because there's a kind of a matter-of-fact quality to mindfulness practice, very matter-of-factly recognize that thinking is happening. Kind of like you look at this thinking phenomena head-on. Oh, I'm a human being who's thinking right now. This is thoughts. This is thinking. Sometimes by kind of looking at the thoughts head on and recognizing it very directly, that's enough to bring a stronger light of awareness to in a sense, overcome the preoccupation. If we're not preoccupied, then a tendency is for the thoughts to kind of dissolve and disappear on their own. And often that's the experience you'll find. If you're really honest and really fully recognize thinking is happening, that recognition is not fueling the thoughts. It's stepping outside of them a little bit, and the thoughts will kind of dissolve, and you can come back to your breathing. Sometimes thoughts are much more compulsive. And even if you recognize them very clearly, the thoughts just keep going on, churning on and on, pulling you off into their world, enchanting you into their world. When you notice, when it's that strong, then what you want to do is notice something different about the thinking than the story itself. And there's a lot of other things you could notice besides the story around the process of thinking. And I suggested to you at the end of the last sitting that you spend a little bit of time looking for that. And I'm wondering if some of you noticed anything. What did you notice besides the content when you paid attention to the process of thinking? Yes?
Feelings.
Great. So you had feelings associated with it. Often there are feelings associated with thoughts. And so when the feelings are there, then you can bring your attention to the feelings connected to the thinking. And when you, as soon as you're involved with the feeling, you're not involved in the story. Caught up in the story. What else?
What if it's a very, very strong emotion that's pulling your thought back to that emotional
experience? What if?
Yeah, what if? I mean, like if you're, you have this such a strong feeling, the thought has to stay on that feeling because it's so strong.
Uh-huh.
When you do your meditation, just sit there and let that happen? Or?
Yeah. Mindfulness be in a sense larger than the emotion and just let it be there and get to know it better. Feel it, sense it, recognize it. And one of the ways to do that is to feel it as a physical sensations. All strong emotions will be felt in the body somewhere. And the body is a great container. The body can contain anything at all. So if you kind of relax and let the body hold your emotion, then the emotion will bounce around inside the body, but it's quite safe and it'll tend to kind of process itself. In shorthand, this is, you know. What else did you notice about the process of thinking? Did you notice anything? Or you were, yes?
I noticed that the thinking is most sort of captivating or preoccupying when every time it almost leads to a conclusion. So I hear you asking us to not let go of thinking completely, but perhaps let go of thinking of knowing anything. I mean, maybe just that's when the story starts to keep playing itself, that you know what the other person is going to do, You know the way you are, and so trying to kind of back off from concluding anything and just spending the time paying attention to the thinking but without really knowing anything.
Are you suggesting perhaps that for you the propulsion, the fuel for your thinking is the quest for knowing?
Some
for understanding?
Yeah, just sort of coming from one conclusion to another about myself or about the way things work, uh-huh, or what's going to happen next or why it happened last night.
But what's fueling that? Looking for conclusion or tending towards conclusion?
The excitement of falsely thinking that I know anything.
So
going from this milestone of, you know, well, I know this, I know that. I mean,
so part of the process of thinking for you is there's also excitement there. Sounds like.
I mean, I think that's a sort of preoccupation or captivation for it. And the story gets fueled less if I just back off from all the attempts at knowing things and just sort of pay attention to the thoughts themselves.
Great. Wonderful. Yes, Nancy.
I noticed when I dropped the storyline, at least shrunk it way down. Psychic energy was still there. Very attached, very strong. And at first I was really judgmental about that. But I've noticed, actually it started this morning when I was meditating, there's more of an acceptance that, well, maybe it's just reminding me I need to attend to this because it's been something I've been sandbagging. You know what I mean? It's a very intense process.
Good. So, what else? Yes?
Pictures.
Some people think in pictures more than in words. And that's just a different way of thinking.
It's just when you said notice, then I noticed that there was a picture.
There's pictures also.
But I hadn't noticed them until you said. Great. They're not very, I don't think I think of pictures as much as a lot of people. They're not very bright. That they are there.
Okay. Yes, Stephanie.
I noticed that as I was thinking about where Steve was, you know, and I kept thinking of me and watching everybody come in, and then I thought to myself, well, I can just close my eyes and listen to sounds, and I can recognize sounds would be more beneficial. than thinking thoughts.
Yes. That's an interesting thing about our relationship to the thinking world. One of the liberating things that for me, was the realization that I didn't have to believe my thoughts. And I had to somehow, along the course of life or growing up, assume that if I had a thought, that had to be true. And, you know, and if it's true, then a lot of things followed. But to realize that thoughts, you know, aren't necessarily true. They're just thoughts. They're just stuff happening. They could bubble up and they pass away. And they're the most ephemeral thing in the world. You know, there's no substance to them. They just kind of, you know. I love the expression virtual reality. The original virtual reality is our thoughts. But you don't have to believe your thoughts. Another thing that was very helpful for me in my own practice was when a teacher told me that there was nothing in the world, for the purposes of meditation, there was nothing that I needed to think about. I thought that was great. Nothing I had to figure out, nothing I had to analyze. That thinking wasn't necessary for the process of meditation to proceed. When thoughts are quite compulsive, quite strong, we want to bring our attention to the phenomena of thinking, matter-of-factly, but we're not really interested in the story connected. So how do we bring our attention to compulsive thinking without being interested, without paying attention to the story? If thoughts are compulsive, there's almost always some other aspect of them besides the story going on. There is sometimes the energetic, physical sensations in the body associated with them. You know, some of us will have tension in our forehead, we frown or something, when we're thinking intensely. Or there's a lot of pressure in our head, or 10,000 bumblebees in our heads, you know, or we feel kind of this upwelling of energy coming from our torso up into our neck and our head, and we're kind of really concerned in thoughts. Tension in the shoulders, perhaps. There can be some tension, some pressure, some tautness, some constriction, some vibration or something. Some physical component part to that kind of compulsive thinking. So what we do in mindfulness practice then is we bring our attention, kind of matter-of-factly, very simply, bring our meditative awareness to that physical aspect of that kind of thinking. Not to get rid of it, not to push it away or judge it, but simply to make room for it and allow it to be there. And notice what happens as we do that. Notice what happens as we hold it in awareness. As we do that, we're strengthening our awareness, the light of awareness, and we're beginning to overcome the forces of preoccupation. And that is a wonderful thing to do. Sometimes it's an emotion that seems very strongly connected to a certain story or certain kind of ideas or certain thoughts. And so then rather than getting involved in the story again, we can go down and feel the emotion. And what is the emotion? Maybe it's anger. Where do you feel the anger in your body? I feel it maybe as a tight burning in my stomach. Okay, great. I can hang out with that. So we hang out for a tight burning in my stomach. What happens is I kind of feel it and sense it, make room for that tightness. Oh, it gets tighter. Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so I'm just going to hang out and let it get tighter. Boy, it's really on fire now. Okay, on fire and being with the fire, that's interesting. It's most of the fire seems to be deep down the pit of my stomach and it seems to be radiating it outwards. Okay, I'll just sense it and feel it. Oh, now it's kind of dissolving a little bit and the fire is getting cooler and it's radiating it out further and further, and now it's no longer hot anymore. It's actually kind of cool. And now I notice that there's actually a lot of calm, whereas before I was angry. So we bring our attention to the emotion that seems to be connected to the powerful thoughts. And the point is not to stop thinking, but the point is to overcome the preoccupation with it, the compulsion to it. Occasionally, the compulsive preoccupation itself can be the subject of mindfulness. Sometimes there's powerful interest or powerful fear that's kind of fueling those thoughts. So we want to bring our attention to the interest or the fear or whatever. Is this all making sense? Sometimes in our meditation or in our life, there can be repeated themes that keep popping up over and over and over again. Even there might be very mild thoughts. It's easy to come back to the breath, but 2 seconds later, we're off in that theme again. So, for example, a common theme for some people is planning. They sit, they start planning the day. They come back to their breath. 2 seconds later, they're planning tomorrow. Come back to the breath. 2 seconds later, they're planning their vacation. Just planning, planning, planning. Yeah? Some people, it's memories. You know, following your breath, you get lost in, you know, what happened at work today. Follow your breath. The conversation you had at work today repeats itself. Follow the breath. Thinking about how you could have done better at work today. All these thoughts about what happened at work today, you know. Or it can be certain fantasies. Keep getting involved in sexual fantasies. Sit down, sexual fantasy. Sit down, another sexual fantasy. Different person, but, you know, off it goes, you know. Or it could be, you know, fantasies of aversion. You know, keep thinking the same kind of aversive thoughts. Whenever there's a repeated pattern in the kind of thoughts you have, then there's almost certainly an underlying emotion, which is kind of like the factory for that kind of concern. And if you don't attend to or acknowledge the emotion will keep churning out those kinds of concerns. So, for example, the tendency is when people plan a lot in meditation, that is being arising out of apprehension or fear. And if you pay attention to when there's a lot of planning thoughts going on, you kind of look around and sense your way, feel your way into what the emotion is that seems to be present. And more often than not, people will find that it's fear. And the fear, apprehension, is what's kind of fueling these kinds of thinking. As soon as you can recognize the emotion, then we bring our attention carefully to the emotion. And if the emotion is attended to and acknowledged, then it doesn't need to make these thoughts anymore. It's almost as if these kinds of thoughts, repetitive kind of thoughts, is kind of like a flag that our emotions life says, hey, dummy, there's something here you should pay attention to. And it's the emotion itself. So if you find yourself over and over and over again thinking the same thing, look around and see if there's some emotion that seems connected to it. And the last thing maybe I can say is that it's useful when you find yourself being mindful of thoughts, and especially initially, is just to label it, thinking, thinking, thinking. Just kind of make a little mental note to yourself, thinking is happening. And that labeling of the thought works the same way I talked about last week with labeling emotions. It's kind of like if you name the dragon in the fairy tale, the dragon loses its power. If you name the thought, then that part of us which names the thought is not caught up in the thought. And so some of the power of preoccupation tends to soften. Does that make sense? Yes?
No. What you were just mentioning, when you notice things coming up, and you want to look around and go through, that's a dilemma that I have over and over meditating. That's the kind of thought that seems useful to do in the process of meditating, that, oh, okay, I'm noticing this theme of permanence judging comes up, here it is again. And so now I'm going to deliberately look and see what the feeling is under it. And that kind of directed thought, which seems very useful, kind of collides with the direction not to think.
Right. Well, yeah. So you can kind of, it's best to be kind of relaxed around all this and not to make too sharp of categories of what is right and what is wrong. So be a little bit relaxed about, you know, your casual thinking, and you're thinking a little bit and kind of casually without kind of a lot of anxiety, and just kind of, maybe I should try this. That's fine to think that way a little bit. It kind of help you find your way. If it's compulsive and you're always doing it that way, it's not so useful. But a little bit, it's fine. I mean, you can't stop thinking. So if that thought occurs to you. But let me suggest a different way of understanding the practice, a different kind of way to get to the same thing. When there's something that's predominant going on, our task is to bring our attention carefully to that experience that's predominant and explore it in all its different aspects, its facets. And get to know all the facets of it better. So it's not so much that we're thinking about what to do, we're just kind of going in there and kind of feeling our way like in the dark, all the different aspects. So with thoughts, you don't have to analyze and figure out when you're supposed to do something different. What you're supposed to do is be fully acknowledge the fact that you're thinking, and then spend some time exploring that realm, silent exploration. If you do that, you'll be aware of your emotions, if that's an important part of it. Does that shift a little bit for you?
Not really, because the practice that I've been doing is to kind of keep letting go. As soon as I notice my attention going somewhere in particular,
uh-huh.
It's to let go of it and come back to the breath.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, what you're talking about, I think, I might be going to like mind you, but I think what I'm going to say, go ahead and explore around, you know, this one aspect where we have to have a principle here that we stand on, kind of guides our meditating. To me, the principle is if you not get attached to any particular line of thought or feeling or anything, but just notice it and let it go. So I'm kind of stuck on what sounds like the same as like notice it and then follow it.
Yeah, well, the basic principle for us is just simply notice better. We're kind of like naturalists going into the wilds and just being tremendously patient just to notice what's happening. That's all. And relying on the power of noticing, the power of mindfulness, the power of awareness to clarify things. Now, if it's really mild thoughts, it's fine to let go of them and come back to the breath. But the kind of the pure mindfulness itself doesn't involve any doing on our part except bringing more careful mindfulness to what's actually going on, getting to know it better. We don't have the idea that there's some better state to be in. We have to let go of something in order to become free. What we have to do is to see it more clearly, and seeing it more clearly, we become free. It's a very powerful practice to always be letting go, but sometimes very subtly and sometimes very grossly, a person can actually be doing themselves a disservice in that process. One of them is, most meditators get very good at letting go eventually. But we can start letting go of things which are inappropriate to let go of. And also we can let go of things before we've learned from them. So for example, people can get very good at letting go of their anger. They let go of their anger, 2 seconds later they get angry again. If you hang out with the anger and get to know it better before you let go of it, then you might see that the anger was born out of fear. And then you kind of address the fear directly, and once you've come to terms with your fear, then you're less likely to get anger in the future. But if you're always letting go of your anger and never noticing the fear underlying it, you're going to be doing a lot of letting go in your life. Does this make sense? So that's kind of the principle of how I teach, is this idea that it's more useful to investigate more deeply. And as we investigate, there'll be a natural letting go. Because everything wants to be released by itself. And all we have to do is bring careful awareness and it will release itself. One of the things about letting go is if we're always doing letting go, it reinforces the notion that we're in charge and in control, and which is not very useful for the deeper possibilities that are available through this kind of practice. Yes?
I think I've been misunderstanding it too. The same way. I mean, I have always thought the first, you know, and that if it keeps coming back, then you go and hang out with it.
That's fine. If it's really mild, kind of random, kind of surface chatter that has no power or no oomph to it, the mind just wanders away, then just let go and come back to the breathing over and over again. But it's when there's more oomph, there's more preoccupation with it, then just notice it. It's like we're waking up to the full realm. Waking up is a very nice metaphor word for what we're doing. We're trying to be awake to what's happening, not necessarily stop what's happening. Yes?
What happens to me is I didn't notice a theme or anything. It's more like watching sitcoms. It's what I did at work yesterday, and another time it's planning my day, the other time it's the sexual fantasy. Different channels. And those thoughts, those they're almost like the daydreams. They take me into their world for minutes at a time, with complete unconsciousness of what I'm supposed to be doing. I mean, I can't even be aware of thinking because I'm not aware of anything
right.
except what that world that I'm in. And then after 5 minutes, I go, oh, gee, I was doing this. I go back to breath. And I try counting the breath so I can stay there longer, and then soon enough, boom, I'm into another story. And when I'm in the story, I'm nowhere else. So I don't see how I can maintain awareness of thinking, because I'm either thinking or aware, but not both at the same time.
So there's no problem. Either you're aware of what's going on, or you're too unaware to even know that there's a problem. This is actually an interesting principle in the practice. We all wander off and get lost in our thoughts. It's part of the territory. What's very interesting is what our reaction is when we notice that's happened. Because sooner or later we wake up, and, oh, I've been lost, I'm thinking about such and such. That moment of noticing is a moment of mindfulness. It's pretty good. Some people will add to that moment, oh shit. Or, oh my God, I blew it. I've been lost. I hope no one noticed. We add all these judgments and reactions to what has just happened in the past. It's a second ago, but it's still in the past. It's not necessary to judge that kind of way. Once we're awake again, just appreciate the fact we're awake, and then try to stay awake. Now, to keep coming back to the breath, and whenever you can, to remember to come back to the breath, begin strengthening the mind, so you're less likely to go off for so long next time. And then you come back and you try to sustain your attention on the breath through time. And as you sustain it through time, you're kind of pushing that muscle to get stronger and stronger. And with time, the habits of getting lost will diminish, and you find yourself more present more of the time. But if you've been meditating for a few weeks or a few months, and the same kind of pattern of kind of getting lost in certain kind of soap opera over and over again happens, then it's often a sign that there's something important happening in the present moment that you haven't noticed yet. And so then it's useful to do the exploration, to kind of look around. What else is going on here that maybe that I haven't noticed? Some, for example, a person might actually be phenomenally lonely. And the loneliness kind of gets this great yearning and pain inside of them. And it's so uncomfortable that they'd rather spend a lot of time in a soap opera with a lot of friends. And so what they haven't noticed, what's happening at the present moment, is the loneliness and the aversion to loneliness that is responsible for keep getting lost over and over again. So when we see this same pattern over and over again, sometimes it's useful to say, "What? Notice. Is there something going on here that I haven't actually noticed?" Spend some time looking around, sensing around, feeling around. And if someone might find, oh, there's loneliness, or there's fear, or there's, you know, something else going on. Does that make sense? And so this question of, you know, how much thinking is part of the practice. We don't need to think when we do this practice, but investigation is a very important part of it. But investigation is not not thoughtful analysis. Investigation is just kind of looking around more carefully. Yes?
I'm very new to the looking around part, I think. I've done other concentration practices before. Sometimes I'm looking around and I'm wondering, while I'm looking around, what's there? Kind of looking. And I've had moments where I thought, is that a thought? In other words, is there a an edge to wondering. The more it becomes thinking.
Yeah. I wouldn't worry too much about it.
Can I rephrase that a little?
Sure.
Is there a way of using your thoughts to go deeper into experiences?
Is there a way of using thoughts to go deeper into your experiences? There is. I mean,
yeah, it is. And it is because it was about investigating.
Right. Right.
Well, yeah. Something that might be new and
you've
never
seen
before is kind of what seems to be
the practice that you're talking about. Well, let me say, the Buddha, when he taught mindfulness, he taught two kinds of mindfulness practices. One was reflective meditation, where a person actually actively thinks about certain themes or ideas. And it's very powerful to reflect and consider things when the mind is very quiet and concentrated. So we get quiet and concentrated and you think about certain things. The classic one in Buddhism is a classic theme for contemplation is death. It's considered to be spiritually very useful to contemplate death. It helps people appreciate life more fully. But there's all kinds of things a person might consider. And it has its place to do that kind of stuff. A very important part of any kind of life is to consider and reflect. The other type that he taught was non-reflective observation, non-reflective presencing of what was happening at any given moment. It's non-discursive presence, non-judgmental, non-discursive, very simple, very relaxed, mindful of what is actually happening as it's happening. It's kind of like pulling the curtains from the window, and then you simply notice what's happening on the street. You don't have to think about it, you just kind of notice what's going on. The kind of meditation that I'm teaching here is a non-discursive form of meditation, where it's more strengthening the ability to simply notice, not strengthening the ability to think. I tend to discourage very much that people do any thinking in this kind of meditation, because most of us who come here, because of our Western culture or whatever, already have phenomenally strong powers and habits of thinking. And to suggest that any thinking is supposed to be part of the meditation reinforces those habits. And so I would encourage you not to do any analysis, not to do any figuring, but see if when something's happening and you want to investigate it, see if the investigation can be non-discursive. It's kind of like imagine you're a spelunker in a cave and it's dark, and you're kind of feeling your way in the dark. The spelunker isn't thinking about what's going on. She's just feeling it as it goes along. So we're sensing our way forward. We're sensing, what else? It's kind of to fill in the web of this moment. What else is going on here? So if we have an emotion, we start feeling the emotion fully. And part of feeling it fully is to feel the physical aspect of it. If a very subtle kind of thought in the back of your mind is kind of saying, okay, there's an emotion present here, and let me bring myself to the physical experience of it. That's fine to have that kind of thought. Don't worry about it. One way that we use thoughts in this non-discursive meditation practice is to label the experience, to have a very subtle, very very subtle whisper of a thought in the mind that very quietly, in a kind of ongoing, steady kind of pace, names the experience as it's happening. Hearing, breathing in, out, itching, thinking, sadness, tension. And so we're naming as we go along. It's not a necessary part of this meditation, but we found that it's be extremely helpful for most people to do this. It's kind of like using a thought to direct our attention to stay present, rather than letting our thoughts kind of do whatever they want, and then to go off on some kind of thought train that takes us away. Yes?
In the naming, I assume you would try to be sort of non-judgmental when you're naming things. There's a whole sort of commentary seems to be related to prejudice, and I've been working a lot on prejudice, not being prejudiced against other people, and not even being prejudiced against prejudiced people, and furthermore, trying not to be prejudiced against myself, and not really knowing how I'm going to act the next time, just because I acted that way a whole bunch of times before. But it seems like there's potential there when you're naming things to say tension, bad tension, and things like that. So, I mean, I like your examples of naming, and I'd want to try to remember not to, well, to stay non-judgmental.
Yeah. Well, part of the usefulness of the noting is that sometimes the quality of the way we note is a very good indication of what our relationship to what's happening. And so that way we learn about that kind of stuff. So if there's physical pain and we go pain, you know, we've gotten involved with the pain rather than just kind of being mindful of it in a kind of matter of fact way. Or if there's some great feelings of delight and joy in the meditation, then we may be going, oh, delight. You know, and we're in...
Finally.
So sometimes the noting, the quality of noting can be a powerful indicator. Well, I'm sorry to make it so complicated for you all. The mindfulness practice is supposed to be incredibly simple. And if you have any doubts about what you're supposed to be doing, err on the side of keeping it simple. Yes?
A while back you said something about that you didn't like the idea that we would get the notion that we were in charge. That letting go of things would give you the notion that you were in charge.
That you're able to always let go of things, that you're the letting goer.
And that that's not a good thing.
Well, I don't know if it's not a good thing, but I mean, to some degree, mindfulness will give us more control over ourselves and the world. So it's very useful. The more mindful you are, the more choice you have. The more choice you have, the more control you have in some situations. At least you have some more control over your reactions, your responses. But the deeper form of freedom that's possible through this meditation is when we're no longer attached to any notion that we are in control. Because ultimately, there is no ultimate control that we can absolutely have. There's no guarantee that we can always control every possible thing that occurs to us. And if we're strengthening that ability to control and identifying ourselves with the controller, then we're setting ourselves up for potential suffering when life takes a turn where we don't have, no longer have a choice. And the experience of being alive, where there's so much trust in life that we don't have to be positing a self that's in control, in charge, but can let life flow freely as it is, including our inner life as it is a phenomenally transformative experience. And this is ultimately, this meditation practice points to this ultimately transformative experience that comes when we're not trying to manipulate the situation or solidifying some sense of me, I'm in charge. Does that make sense? It can be very challenging to people. It can be very threatening. Because some people need to feel they have more control over life in order to operate better, in order to function better. And in that sense, mindfulness will give you that stronger sense of just being mindful, as I said. A lot more sense of choice arises through doing this kind of practice. But to learn that we have the resources, it can be very threatening to people, because there's a lot of people who don't trust life enough to put down their guard, to not always feel like they have to be defending themselves. And one of the great opportunities in this kind of practice is to have some, at least in the meditation itself, some taste of what it's like to be alive, where all our defenses and all our guards are down. You can choose whether you want to keep them down in your daily life, but to have that experience, at least in meditation, is tremendously purifying and transformative. And if we're still holding on to very subtle notions that I'm in charge, I'm in control, we don't have that full taste of what's possible when we let go of it all. I'd like to stop all this talking. I feel probably it's more and more confusing as I keep talking here. So I apologize for confusing you. This is partly why we wait until the fourth week to talk about thoughts as part of the meditation, so you don't spend all your time thinking. So let's to take a comfortable but alert posture. Gently close your eyes. And then without losing your alert posture, imagine for a moment, for a little bit, that you're sitting in the most comfortable easy chair, looking out a window. And you're not trying to look at anything. But as you rest in your easy chair, things appear in your window. Without expecting it, a butterfly appears. And you're aware there's a butterfly there. The butterfly goes away, and a cloud drifts across the sky. And you're aware the cloud is appearing through the window. A bird flies by, and you're aware the bird flies by. There's no effort on your part, nor trying to look or making efforts. You're simply aware of what happens as it occurs. In the same way, sit in a relaxed way and keep the window of your mindfulness, awareness, awake or open. Don't try to make anything happen. Don't go looking for something to happen. But simply notice what it is that passes through the field of awareness. When not much is going on, experience the breathing, breathing in, breathing out. When a physical sensation appears in the field of awareness, when it appears on its own, you don't have to go looking for it, and it becomes predominant, then simply, matter-of-factly, be aware that the physical sensation has arisen and is there. Allow yourself to feel it, see it fully. When an emotion appears through the window, an emotion arises, recognize the emotion is there. Get to know it better. Feel it in your body. When a thought arises in the window, and a thought is predominant, then simply be aware the thinking is there. And if it persists compulsively, the thoughts, then take a little closer look at what the experience, the phenomena of thinking is at that moment. But stay in your easy chair, the easy chair of mindfulness, allowing things to appear to you. You don't have to go looking for anything. You don't have to figure anything out. Allowing the experience of breathing to appear to you. begin to notice a difference between being awake to what's happening versus being caught up in what's happening. So if this instruction today is too complicated or difficult for some of you, you can just forget about it. And it's possible to make meditation as simple as just staying with the breath. But thoughts are an important part of our life. And part of the function of this kind of instructions and this kind of meditation is not simply to learn how to be present for aspects of our meditative life, but to learn how to wake up usefully to our everyday life, our normal workaday life and relationship life with people, and then to be aware of all aspects of our life, our physical, our emotional, our cognitive, is very useful. But please make it simple, and the idea is to kind of relax in the allowing of what's happening rather than making it complicated. I did bring with me today copies of a book that I co-edited called Voices from Spirit Rock. And in the introduction for it, I wrote kind of the basic instructions for mindfulness practice. If you want to see it written the way I write it, maybe you don't now, but it's there in that book. And